say with absolute certainty. Maybe it was the week's sleep deprivation. Maybe it was the stress of the job. Maybe it was the stress of having to face his second crisis. Maybe it was the fact that Ryan was himself still a carded national intelligence officer. Look, I'm going to say this once. Your job isn't to cover your ass. Your job is to cover mine. I know that, Mr. President. That's why I'm giving you all the information I have. Ryan didn't have to listen to the rest of the speech. He'd heard it all before a couple of hundred times. There had even been cases when he'd said similar things himself. But in Jack's case, he'd always hung his hat on one of the options. "Scott?" Jack asked the acting sextate. "The son of a bitch is dead as yesterday's fish," Adler replied. "Disagreement?" President Ryan asked the others in the room. Nobody contradicted the assessment, giving it a sort of blessing. Even the NIO would not disagree with the collective opinion. He delivered his assessments, after all. Any mistakes now were the Secretary of State's problem. Perfect. "Who was the shooter?" Andrea Price asked. The answer came from CIA's Iraq desk officer. "Unknown. I have people running tapes of previous appearances just to make sure that he's been around before. Look, from all appearances, it was a senior member of his protection detail, with the rank of an army colonel, and I damned well know everybody on my detail," Price concluded the statement. "So whoever it was, he belonged there. And that means whoever pulled this off managed to get somebody all the way inside, close enough to make the hit, and committed enough to pay the price for it. It must have taken years." The continuation of the tape, they'd watched that only 5 times, showed the man crumble after a cavalcade of pistol shots at point-blank range. That struck Agent Price as odd. You damned well wanted to bag such people alive. Dead men still didn't tell any tales, and executions could always be arranged. Unless he'd been killed by other members of a conspiracy. But how likely was it that more than one assassin had made it that far? Price reflected that she could ask Indira Gandhi that some day. Her whole detail had turned on her one afternoon in a garden. For Price, that was the final infamy, killing the person you were sworn to defend. But then she hadn't sworn to defend such people as that. One other thing on the tape got her attention. "Did you notice the body language?"
"What do you mean?" Ryan asked.
"The way the gun came up. The way he took the shot. The way he just stood there and watched. Like a golfer, it's called follow-through. He must have waited a long time for the chance. He damn sure thought about it for a long, long time. He must have dreamed about it. He wanted the moment to be perfect. He wanted to see it and enjoy it before he went down." She shook her head slowly. That was one focused, dedicated killer. Price was actually enjoying herself, chilling though the subject of the meeting was. More than one president had treated the Secret Service agents as if they were furniture, or at best, nice pets. It wasn't often that big shots asked their opinion of much more than narrow professional areas, like where a bad guy might be in a particular crowd.
"Keep going," CIA said.
"He must have been from outside, a guy with a totally clean record, no connection at all with anybody who made noise in Baghdad. This wasn't a guy getting even for somebody taking his mother out, okay? It was somebody who worked his way up the system, slow and careful, all the way."
"Iran," CIA said.
"Best guess, anyway. Religious motivation. No way he'd walk away from the hit, so it had to be somebody who didn't care. That could also mean straight revenge, but Miss Price is correct. His people were clean in that respect. Anyway, it wasn't the Israelis. Wasn't the French. The Brits don't do this anymore. The domestic angle is probably taken out by their vetting procedures. So it wasn't for money. It wasn't for personal or family motives. I think we can discount political ideology. That leaves religion, and that means Iran.
I can't say I'm familiar with all the intelligence side, but from looking at the tape, yeah," Andrea Price agreed. "It's like he was saying a prayer, the way he killed the guy. He just wanted the moment to be perfect. He didn't care about anything else.
Somebody else to check that out? Ryan asked.
FBI. Their behavioral sciences people are pretty good at reading minds. We work with them all the time, Price responded.
Good idea, CIA agreed.
We'll rattle the bushes to ID the shooter. But even if we can get good information, it might not mean anything.
What about the timing?
If we can stipulate that the shooter was there for a while, we have enough tapes of public appearances to determine that, then timing is an issue, CIA thought.
Oh, that's just great, the president opined.
Scott, now what?
Bert, Sextate said to his desk officer. Bert Vasco was the State Department senior desk officer for that country. Rather like a specialist in the trading industry, he concentrated his efforts on learning everything he could about one particular country.
Mr. President, as we all know, Iraq is a majority Shia Muslim country ruled by a Sunni minority through the Ba'ath political party. It has always been a concern that the elimination of our friend over there could topple...
Tell me what I don't know, Ryan interrupted.
Mr. President, we simply do not know the strength of any opposition group that may or may not exist. The current regime has been very effective at cutting the weeds down early. A handful of Iraqi political figures has defected to Iran. None are top-quality people, and none ever had the chance to develop a firm political base. There are two radio stations that broadcast from Iran into Iraq. We know the names of the defectors who used those transmitters to talk to their countrymen. But there's no telling how many people listen and pay attention. The regime isn't exactly popular, we know that. We do not know the strength of the opposition, or what sort of organization exists to make use of an opportunity such as this one.
CIA nodded.
Bert's right. Our friend was awfully good at identifying potential enemies and taking them out of play. We tried to help during and after the Persian Gulf War, but all we really managed to do was get people killed. For sure nobody over there trusts us.
Ryan sipped at his coffee and nodded. He'd made his own recommendations back in 1991, and they hadn't been exercised. Well, he'd still been a junior executive then.
"Do we have any options to play?" the president asked next.
"Honestly, no," Vasco answered.
CIA agreed.
"No assets in place. What few people we have operating in that country are tasked to coverage of weapons development, nuclear, chemical, and so forth. Nobody on the political side. We actually have more people in Iran looking at the political side. We can rattle those bushes some, but not in Iraq."
Fabulous, Jack thought. A country may or may not go down in one of the most sensitive areas of the world, and the world's most powerful nation could do nothing more than watch television coverage of the event. So much for the power of the American presidency.
Arnie?
Yes, Mr. President, the chief of staff replied.
We bumped Mary Pat off the schedule a couple days ago. I want her in today if we can work the schedule.
I'll see what we can do on that, but when something like this happens, the President of the United States is supposed to have more than his dick in his hand.
Ryan paused.
Is Iran going to make a move?
Chapter 10. Politics. Prince Ali bin Sheikh had been ready to fly home on his personal aircraft, an aging but beautifully appointed Lockheed L-1011, when the call came in from the White House. The Saudi embassy was located close to the Kennedy Center, and the ride, correspondingly short in his official limousine, accompanied by a security force almost as large as Ryan's and made up of American Diplomatic Protection Service personnel, plus the prince's own detail, composed of former members of Britain's Special Air Service. The Saudis, as always, spent a lot of money and bought quality with it. Ali was no stranger to the White House, or to Scott Adler, who met him at the door and conducted him upstairs and east into the Oval Office.
"Mr. President," His Royal Highness said, walking in from the secretary's room,
"thank you for coming over on such short notice."
Jack shook his hand and waved him to one of the room's two sofas. Some thoughtful person had started a fire in the fireplace.
The White House photographer snapped a few shots and was dismissed.
"I imagine you've seen the news this morning."
Ali managed a worried smile.
"What does one say? We will not mourn his passing, but the kingdom has serious concerns."
"Do you know anything we don't?" Ryan asked. The prince shook his head.
"I was as surprised as everyone else."
The president grimaced.
"You know, with all the money we spend on—"
His visitor raised a tired hand.
"Yes, I know. I will have the same conversation with my own ministers as soon as my airplane lands back home."
"Iran?"
"Undoubtedly."
"Will they move?" The Oval Office got quiet then, just the crackling of the seasoned oak in the fireplace as the three men, Ryan, Ali, and Adler, traded looks across the coffee table, the tray and cups on it untouched. The issue was, of course, oil. The Persian, sometimes called the Arabian Gulf, was a finger of water surrounded by, and in some places sitting atop, a sea of oil. Most of the world's known supply was there, divided mainly among the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Iraq, and Iran, along with the smaller United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and Qatar. Of these countries, Iran was by far the largest in terms of population. Next came Iraq. The nations of the Arabian Peninsula were richer, but the land atop their liquid wealth had never supported a large population. And there was the rub, first exposed in 1991, when Iraq had invaded Kuwait with all the grace of a schoolyard bully's attack on a smaller child. Ryan had more than once said that aggressive war was little more than an armed robbery writ large, and such had been the case in the Persian Gulf War. Seizing upon a minor territorial dispute and some equally trivial economic issues as an excuse, Saddam Hussein had attempted at a stroke to double his country's inherent wealth, and then threatened to double down his bets yet again by attacking Saudi Arabia. The reason he'd stopped at the Kuwait-Saudi border would now remain forever unexplained. At the most easily understood level, it was about oil and oil's resulting wealth. But there was more to it than that. Hussein, like a mafia don, had thought about little more than money and the political power that money generated. Iran was somewhat more far-sighted. All the nations around the Gulf were Islamic, most of them very strictly so. There were the exceptions of Bahrain and Iraq. In the former case, the oil had essentially run out, and that country, really a city-state separated from the kingdom by a causeway, had evolved into the same function that Nevada exercised for the western United States, a place where the normal rules were set aside, where drinking, gambling, and other pleasures could be indulged a convenient distance from a more restrictive home. In the latter case, Iraq was a secular state which paid scant lip service to the state religion, which largely explained its president's demise after a long and lively career. But the key to the region was and would always be religion. The Saudi kingdom was the living heart of Islam. The Prophet had been born there. The holy cities of Mecca and Medina were there, and from that point of origin had grown one of the world's great religious movements. The issue was less about oil than about faith. Saudi Arabia was of the Sunni branch, and Iran of the Shia. Ryan had once been briefed in on the differences, which had at the time seemed so marginal that he'd made no effort to remember them. That, the president told himself now, was foolish. The differences were large enough to make two important countries into enemies, and that was as large as any difference needed to be. It wasn't about wealth, per se. It was about a different sort of power, the sort that grew from the mind and the heart, and from there into something else. Oil and money just made the struggle more interesting to outsiders. A lot more interesting. The industrial world depended on that oil. Every state on the Gulf feared Iran for its size, for its large population, and for the religious fervor of its citizens. For the Sunni religious, the fear was about a perceived departure from the true course of Islam. For everyone else, it was about what would happen to them when heretics assumed control of the region. Because Islam is a comprehensive system of beliefs, spreading out into civil law and politics and every other form of human activity. For Muslims, the word of God was law itself. For the West, it was continuing their economies. For the Arabs, Iran is not an Arab country, it was the most fundamental question of all, a man's place before his God.
"Yes, Mr. President," Prince Ali bin Sheikh replied after a moment, "they will move."
His voice was admirably calm, though Ryan knew that inwardly he must be anything but. The Saudis had never wanted Iraq's president to fall. Enemy though he was, apostate though he was, aggressor though he had fulfilled a useful strategic purpose for his neighbors. Iraq had long been a buffer between the Gulf states and Iran. It was a case in which religion played second fiddle to politics, which thereby served religious purposes. By rejecting the word of Allah, Iraq's majority Shia population was taken out of play, and the dual border with Kuwait and the kingdom was one of mere politics, not religion. But if the Ba'at party fell along with its leader, then Iraq might revert to majority religious rule. That would put a Shia country on the two borders, and the leader of the Shia branch of Islam was Iran. Iran would move because Iran had been moving for years. The religion systematized by Muhammad had spread from the Arabian Peninsula to Morocco in the west and the Philippines in the east, and with the evolution of the modern world was represented in every nation on earth. Iran had used its wealth and its large population to become the world's leading Islamic nation, by bringing in Muslim clergy to its own holy city of Qum to study, by financing political movements throughout the Islamic world, and by funneling weapons to Islamic peoples who needed help. The Bosnian Muslims were a case in point, and not the only one.
"Anschluss," Scott Adler thought aloud. Prince Ali just looked over and nodded.
"Do we have any sort of plan to help prevent it?" Jack asked. He knew the answer. No, nobody did. That was the reason the Persian Gulf War had been fought for limited military objectives, and not to overthrow the aggressor. The Saudis, who had from the beginning charted the war's strategic objectives, had never allowed America or her allies even to consider a drive to Baghdad, and this despite the fact that with Iraq's army deployed in and around Kuwait, the Iraqi capital had been as exposed as a nudist on a beach. Ryan had remarked at the time, watching the talking heads on various TV news shows, that not a single one of the commentators remarked that a textbook campaign would have totally ignored Kuwait, seized Baghdad, and then waited for the Iraqi army to stack arms and surrender. Well, not everyone could read a map.
"Your Highness, what influence can you exercise there?" Ryan inquired next.
"In practical terms, very little. We will extend the hand of friendship, offer loans. By the end of the week, we will ask America and the UN to lift sanctions with an eye to improving economic conditions, but..."
"Yeah, but," Ryan agreed.
"Your Highness, please let us know what information you can develop. America's commitment to the kingdom's security is unchanged."
Ali nodded.
"I will convey that to my government."
"Nice professional job," Ding observed, catching the enhanced instant replay. "Except for one little thing."
"Yeah, it is nice to collect the paycheck before your will is probated."
Clark had once been young enough and angry enough to think in such terms as the shooter, whose death he'd just seen repeated. But with age had come circumspection. Now, he'd heard, Mary Pat wanted him to try again for a White House appearance, and he was reading over a few documents. Trying to, anyway.
"John ever read up on the assassins?" Chavez asked, killing the TV with the remote.
"I saw the movie," Clark replied without looking up.
"They were pretty serious boys.
They had to be. Using swords and knives, well, you have to get pretty close to do the job. Decisively engaged, like we used to say in the Seventh Light. Chavez was still short of his master's degree in international relations, but he blessed all the books that Professor Alfer had forced him to read. He waved at the TV. This guy was like one of them, a two-legged smart bomb. You self-destruct, but you take out the target first. The assassins were the first terrorist state. I guess the world wasn't ready for the concept back then, but that one little city-state manipulated a whole region just 'cause they could get one of their troops in close enough to do the job on anybody.
Thanks for the history lesson, Domingo, but think, John. If they could get close to him, they can get close to anybody. Ain't no pension plan in the dictator business, you know. The security around him is, like, real, real tight. But somebody got a shooter in close and blew him into the next dimension. That's scary, Mr. C.
John Clark continually had to remind himself that Domingo Chavez was no dummy. He might still speak with an accent, not because he had to, but because it was natural for him to. Chavez, like Clark, had a gift for language. And he might still interlace his speech with terms and grammar remembered from his days as an army sergeant, but goddamn if he wasn't the quickest learner John had ever met. He was even learning to control his temper and passion. When it suited him to, John corrected himself.
So? Different culture, different motivation, different...
John, I'm talking about a capability. The political will to use it, Mano. And patience. It must have taken years. Sleeper agents I know about. First time I saw a sleeper shooter.
Could have been a regular guy who just got pissed and...
Who was willing to die?
I don't think so, John.
Why not pop the guy on the way to the latrine at midnight and try to get the hell out of Dodge?
No way, Mr. C. Gomer there was making a statement.
Wasn't just his, either. He was delivering a message for his boss, too.
Clark looked up from his briefing papers and thought about that one. Another government employee might have dismissed the observation as something out of his purview, but Clark had been suborned into government service as a result of his inability to see limits on his activities. Besides that, he could remember being in Iran, being part of a crowd shouting death to America at blindfolded captives from the U.S. Embassy. More than that, he remembered what members of that crowd had said after Operation Blue Light had gone to shit, and how close it had been. How near the Khomeini government had been to taking out its wrath on Americans and turning an already nasty dispute into a shooting war. Even then, Iranian fingerprints were on all manner of terrorist operations worldwide, and America's failure to address the fact hadn't helped matters.
Well, Domingo, that's why we need more field officers.
Surgeon had one more reason not to like her husband's presidency. She couldn't see him on the way out the door, for one thing. He was in with somebody. Well, it had to do with what she'd seen on the morning news, and that was business. And sometimes she'd had to scoot out of the house unexpectedly for a case at Hopkins. But she didn't like the president. She looked at the motorcade. Nothing else to call it. A total of 6 Chevy Suburbans. 3 were tasked to getting Sally, now codenamed Shadow, and little Jack, shortstop, to school. The other 3 would conduct Katie, Sandbox, to her daycare center. Partly, Kathy Ryan admitted, that was her fault. She didn't want the children's lives disrupted. She wouldn't countenance changing their schools and friends because of the misfortune that had dropped on their lives. None of this was the kids' fault. She'd been dumb enough to agree to Jack's new post, which had lasted all of 5 minutes. And as with many things in life, you had to accept the consequences. One consequence was increased travel time to their classes and finger painting, just to keep friends. But damn it. There was no right answer.
"Good morning, Katie." It was Don Russell squatting down for a hug and a kiss from Sandbox. Kathy had to smile at that. This agent was a godsend. A man with grandchildren of his own, he truly loved kids, especially little ones. He and Katie had hit it right off. Kathy kissed her youngest goodbye, and her bodyguard,
It was just outrageous. A child needed a bodyguard. But Kathy remembered her own experiences with terrorists, and she had to accept that, too. Russell lifted Sandbox into her car seat, strapped her in, and the first set of three vehicles pulled away. "Bye, Mom." Sally was going through a phase in which she and Mom were friends, and didn't kiss. Kathy accepted that without liking it. It was the same with little Jack. "See ya, Mom." But John Patrick Ryan Jr. was boy enough to demand a front seat, which he'd get this one time. Both sub-details were augmented due to the manner in which the Ryan family had come to the White House, with a total of 20 agents assigned to protect the children for the time being. That number would come down in a month or so, they'd told her. The kids would ride in normal cars instead of the armored Suburbans. In the case of Surgeon, her helicopter was waiting. Damn, it was all happening again. She'd been pregnant with little Jack, then to learn that terrorists were... Why the hell had she ever agreed to this? The greatest indignity of all, she was married to supposedly the world's most powerful man, but he and his family both had to take orders from other people. "I know, Doc." It was the voice of Roy Altman, her principal agent. "Hell of a way to live, isn't it?" Kathy turned. "You read minds?" "Part of the job, ma'am. I know. Please, my name is Kathy. Jack and I are both Dr. Ryan." Altman nearly blushed. More than one first lady had taken on royal airs with the accession of her husband to POTUS, and the children of politicians weren't always fun to guard. But the Ryan family, the detail members had already agreed, were not at all like the people they usually had to guard. In some ways, that was bad news, but it was hard not to like them. "Here." He handed over a manila folder. It was her caseload for the day. "Two procedures, then follow-ups," she told him. Well, at least she could do paperwork on the flight. That was convenient, wasn't it? "I know. We've arranged with Professor Katz to keep us posted, so we can keep up with your schedule," Altman explained. "Do you do background checks on my patients, too?" Kathy asked, thinking it a joke. It wasn't. "Yes. Hospital records provide names, birthdays, and social security numbers. We run NCIC checks, and checks against our own file of people we keep an eye on." The look that pronouncement generated wasn't exactly friendly, but Altman didn't take it personally. They walked back into the building, then back out a few minutes later to the waiting helicopter. There were news cameras, Kathy saw, to record the event, as Colonel Hank Goodman lit up his engines. In the operations room for the U.S. Secret Service, a few blocks away, the status board changed. POTUS, President of the United States, was shown by the red LED display as in the White House. FLOTUS, First Lady of the United States, was shown as in transit. Shadow, Shortstop, and Sandbox were covered on a different board. The same information was relayed by secure digital radio link to Andrea Price, sitting and reading the paper outside the Oval Office. Other agents were already at St. Mary's Catholic School and the Giant Steps Daycare Center, both near Annapolis, and at Johns Hopkins Hospital. The Maryland State Police knew that the Ryan children were rolling along U.S. Route 50 and had additional cars posted along the travel route for an obvious police presence. At the moment, yet another Marine helicopter was following Surgeons, and a third, with a team of heavily armed agents aboard, was pacing the three children. Were there a serious assassin out there, then he would see the overt display of force. The agents in the moving vehicles would be at their usual alert state, scanning for cars, filing them away for the chance that the same one would show up a little too much. Unmarked Secret Service cars would maneuver around independently, doing much the same thing while being disguised as ordinary commuters. The Ryans would never really know how much security was arrayed around them, unless they asked, and few ever wanted to know. A normal day was underway. There was no denying it now. She didn't need Dr. Moody to tell her. The headaches had worsened,
the fatigue had gotten worse. As with young Benedict Macusa, she'd thought. Then hoped it might be a recurrence of her old malaria, the first time she'd ever entertained that sort of thought. But then the pains had come, not in the joints, but in the stomach, first of all. And that had been like watching an advancing weather front, the tall white clouds that led a massive, violent storm. And there was nothing for her to do but wait and dread what was approaching, for she knew everything that was to be. Part of her mind still denied it, and another part tried to hide away in prayer and faith. But as with a person at a horror movie, face covered by denying hands, her eyes still peeked sideways to see what was coming, the horror all the worse because of her useless retreat from it. The nausea was worse, and soon she'd be unable to control it with her will, strong as that was. She was in one of the hospital's few private rooms. The sun was still bright outside, the sky clear, a beautiful day in the unending African spring-summer season. An IV tree was next to her bed, running sterile saline into her arm, along with some mild analgesics and nutrients to fortify her body. But really, it was a waiting game. Sister Jean-Baptiste could do little else but wait. Her body was limp with fatigue, and so pained that turning her head to look at the flowers out the window required a minute of effort. The first massive surge of nausea came almost as a surprise, and somehow she managed to grasp the emesis tray. She was still nurse enough and detached enough to see the blood there, even as Maria Magdalena took the tray away from her, to empty it into a special container. Fellow nurse and fellow nun, she was dressed in sterile garb, wearing rubber gloves and a mask as well, her eyes unable to conceal her sorrow.
"Hello, sister."
It was Dr. Moody, dressed much the same way, his darker eyes more guarded above the green mask. He checked the chart hanging at the foot of the bed. The temperature reading was only 10 minutes old and still rising. The telex from Atlanta concerning her blood had arrived even more recently, inspiring his immediate walk to the isolation building. Her fair skin had been pale only a few hours earlier. Now it appeared slightly flushed and dry. Moody thought they'd work to cool the patient down with alcohol, maybe ice later, to fight the fever. That would be bad for the sister's dignity. They did indeed dress chastely, as women should, and the hospital gown she now wore was ever demeaning to that virtue. Worse still, however, was the look in her eyes. She knew. But he still had to say it.
"Sister," the physician told her, "your blood has tested positive for Ebola antibodies." A nod. "I see." "Then you also know," he added gently, "that 20% of the patients survive this disease. You are not without hope. I am a good doctor. Sister Magdalena here is a superb nurse. We will support you as best we can. I am also in contact with some of my colleagues. We will not give up on you. I require that you do not give up on yourself. Talk to your God, good lady. He will surely listen to someone of your virtue."
The words came easily, for Moody was after all a physician and a good one. He surprised himself by half wishing for her survival.
"Thank you, doctor."
Moody turned to the other nun before leaving.
"Please keep me informed."
"Of course, doctor." Moody walked out of the room, turning left toward the door, removing his protective garb as he went, and dumping the articles into the proper container. He made a mental note to speak to the administrator to be sure that the necessary precautions were strictly enforced. He wanted this nun to be the last Ebola case in this hospital. Even as he spoke, part of the World Health Organization team was on its way to the Macusa family, where they would interview the grief-stricken parents, along with neighbors and friends, to learn where and how Benedict might have encountered the infection. The best guess was a monkey bite. But only a guess. There was little known about Ebola Zaire, and most of the unknowns were important.
Doubtless it had been around for centuries, or even longer than that. Just one more lethal malady in an area replete with them, not recognized as anything more than jungle fever by physicians as recently as 30 years before. The focal center of the virus was still a matter of speculation. Many thought a monkey carried it, but which monkey no one knew. Literally thousands had been trapped or shot in the effort to determine that, with no result. They weren't even sure that it was really a tropical disease. The first properly documented outbreak of this class of fever had actually taken place in Germany. There was a very similar disease in the Philippines. Ebola appeared and disappeared, like some sort of malignant spirit. There was an apparent periodicity to it. The recognized outbreaks had occurred at 8 to 10 year intervals. Again, unexplained and slightly suspect, because Africa was still primitive, and there was ample reason to believe that victims could contract the disease and die from it in but a few days, without the time to seek medical help. The structure of the virus was somewhat understood, and its symptoms recognized, but its mechanism was still a mystery. That was troubling to the medical community because Ebola Zaire had a mortality rate of roughly 80%. Only 1 in 5 of its victims survived, and why that happened was just one more entry in the unknown column. For all of those reasons, Ebola was perfect. So perfect that it was one of the most feared organisms known to man. Minute quantities of the virus were in Atlanta, the Pasteur Institute in Paris, and a handful of other institutions, where it was studied under conditions resembling those of a science fiction novel, the doctors and technicians in virtual spacesuits. There wasn't even enough known about Ebola to do work on a vaccine. The 4 known varieties, the 4th had been discovered in a bizarre incident in America, but that strain, while uniformly lethal to monkeys, incomprehensibly had no serious effects on humans, were too different. Even now, scientists in Atlanta, some of whom he knew, were peering into electron microscopes to map the structure of this new version, later to compare it with samples of other known strains. That process could take weeks, and probably, as with all previous efforts, would yield only equivocal results. Until the true focal center of the disease was discovered, it remained an alien virus, something almost from another planet, deadly and mysterious. Perfect. Patient Zero, Benedict Makusa, was dead, his body incinerated by gasoline, and the virus dead with him. Maudi had a small blood sample, but that wasn't really good enough. Sister Jean-Baptiste was something else, however. Maudi thought about it for a moment, then lifted the phone to call the Iranian embassy in Kinshasa. There was work to be done, and more work to prepare. His hand hesitated, the receiver halfway from the desk to his ear. What if God did listen to her prayers? He might, Maudi thought. He just might. She was a woman of great virtue who spent as much of her day in prayer as any believer in his home city of Qum, whose faith in her God was firm, and who had devoted her life to service of those in need. Those were 3 of Islam's 5 pillars, to which he could add a 4th. The Christian Lent wasn't so terribly different from the Islamic Ramadan. These were dangerous thoughts, but if Allah heard her prayers, then what he intended to do was not written, and would not happen. And if her prayers were not heard? Maudi cradled the phone between his ear and shoulder and made the call.
Mr. President, we can't ignore it any more.
Yeah, I know, Arnie.
It came down to a technical issue, oddly enough. The bodies had to be identified positively because a person wasn't dead until there was a piece of paper that said so. And until that person was declared dead, if that person had been a senator or congressperson, then his or her post wasn't vacant, and no new person could be selected for it, and Congress was an empty shell. The certificates would be going out today, and within an hour, governors of the several states would be calling Ryan for advice, or to advise what they would be doing unbidden.
At least one governor would today resign his post and be appointed to the United States Senate by his succeeding lieutenant governor, in an elegant, if obvious, political payoff, or so the rumors said. The volume of information was stunning, even to someone familiar with the sources. It went back over 14 years. The timing could scarcely have been better, however, since that was about the time the major newspapers and magazines had gone to electronic media, which was easily cross-loaded to the World Wide Web, and for which the media empires could charge a modest fee for material which otherwise would have been stored in their own musty basements or at most sold to college libraries for practically nothing. The World Wide Web was still a fairly new and untested source of income, but the media had seized it by the throat, since now, for the first time, news was less volatile than it had been in the past. It was now a ready source for its own reporters, for students, for those with individual curiosity, and for those whose curiosity was more strictly professional. Best of all, the huge number of people doing a keyword search would make it impossible for anyone to check all the inquiries. He was careful anyway. Rather, his people were. The inquiries being made on the web were all happening in Europe, mainly in London, through brand new Internet access accounts which would last no longer than the time required to download the data, or which came from academic accounts to which numerous people had access. Keywords Ryan John Patrick, Ryan Jack, Ryan Carolyn, Ryan Kathy, Ryan Children, Ryan Family, and a multitude of others were inputted, and literally thousands of hits had resulted. Many were spurious because Ryan was not that uncommon a name, but the vetting process was not all that difficult. The first really interesting clips came when Ryan had been 31 and had first come into the public spotlight in London. Even the photos were there, and though they took time to download, they were worth waiting for. Especially the first. That one showed a young man sitting on a street covered with blood.
Well, wasn't that inspirational? The subject of the photograph actually looked quite dead in it, but he knew that wounded people often appeared that way. Then had come another set of photos of a wrecked automobile and a small helicopter. In the intervening years, the data on Ryan was surprisingly scarce, mainly squibs about his testifying before the American Congress behind closed doors. There were additional hits concerning the end of the Fowler presidency. Immediately after the initial confusion, it had been reported that Ryan himself had prevented a nuclear missile launch, and Ryan himself had hinted at it to Darii. But that story had never been officially confirmed, and Ryan himself had never discussed the matter with anyone. That was important. That said something about the man. But that could also be set aside. His wife. There was ample press coverage on her, too, including, in one article, the number of her office at her hospital. A skilled surgeon. That was nice. A recent piece said that she'd continue that. Excellent. They knew where to look for her. The children. The youngest. Yes, the youngest used the same daycare center that the oldest had used. There was a photo of that, too. A feature article on Ryan's first White House job had even identified the school the older ones attended. This was all quite amazing. He'd initiated the research effort in the knowledge that he'd get all or most of this information, but even so, here was, in a single day, more information than 10 people in the field could have gathered, at considerable risk of exposure, in a week. The Americans were so foolish. They practically invited attack. They had no idea of secrecy or security. It was one thing for a leader to appear in public with his family from time to time. Everyone did that. It was quite another to let everyone know things that nobody really needed to know. The document package, it came to over 2,500 pages, would be collated and cross-referenced by his staff. There were no plans to take action on any of it. It was just data. But that could change.
"You know, I think I like flying in," Kathy Ryan observed to Roy Altman.
"Oh?
Less wear and tear on the nerves than driving myself. I don't suppose that'll last," she added, moving into the food line.
"Probably not."
Altman was constantly looking around, but there were two other agents in the room, doing their best to look invisible and failing badly at it. Though Johns Hopkins was an institution with fully 2,400 physicians, it was still a professional village of sorts, where nearly everyone knew nearly everyone else, and doctors didn't carry guns. Altman was staying close, the better to learn his principal's routine, and she didn't seem to mind. He'd been in with her for the two morning procedures, and, teacher that she was, Kathy had explained every step of the process in minute detail. This afternoon she'd be doing teaching rounds with a half dozen or so students. It was Altman's first educational experience on the job, at least in something that had value in an area other than politics, a field he'd learned to detest. His next observation was that Surgeon ate like the proverbial bird. She got to the end of the line and paid for her lunch and Altman's over his brief protest.
"This is my turf, Roy."
She looked around and spotted the man she wanted to lunch with heading that way with Altman in tow.
"Hey, Dave."
Dean James and his guest stood up.
"Hi, Kathy. Let me introduce a new faculty member, Pierre Alexander. Alex, this is Kathy Ryan."
"The same one who..."
"Please, I'm still a doctor, and..."
"You're the one on the Lasker list, right?"
Alexander stopped her cold with that one. Kathy's smile lit up the room.
"Yes."
"Congratulations, doctor."
He held out his hand. Kathy had to set her tray down to take it. Altman watched with eyes that tried to be neutral but conveyed something else.
"You must be with the service."
"Yes, sir. Roy Altman."
"Excellent. A lady this lovely and this bright deserves proper protection," Alexander pronounced.
"I just got out of the Army, Mr. Altman. I've seen you guys at Walter Reed. Back when President Fowler's daughter came back from Brazil with a tropical bug, I managed the case."
"Alex is working with Ralph Forster," the dean explained as everyone sat down. "Infectious diseases," Kathy told her bodyguard. Alexander nodded.
"Just learning the ropes at the moment, but I have a parking pass, so I guess I really belong."
"I hope you're as good a teacher as Ralph is."
"A great doc," Alexander agreed.
Kathy decided she'd like the newbie. She next wondered about the accent and the southern manners.
"Ralph flew down to Atlanta this morning."
"Anything special happening?"
"A possible Ebola case in Zaire, African male, age 8. The email came through this morning."
Kathy's eyes narrowed at that. Though she was in a completely different field of medicine, like all physicians, she got morbidity and mortality report, and she kept current on everything she could. Medicine is a field in which education never stops.
"Just one?"
"Yep."
Alexander nodded.
"Seems the kid had a monkey bite on his arm. I've been over there. I deployed out of Dietrich for the last mini-outbreak in 1990.
"With Gus Lawrence?" Dean James asked. Alexander shook his head.
"No, Gus was doing something else then. The team leader was George Westphal."
"Oh, yeah, he..."
"Died," Alex confirmed. "We kept it quiet, but he got it. I attended him. It wasn't real great to watch."
"What did he do wrong?" "I didn't know him well," James said, "but Gus told me he was a rising star, UCLA, as I recall."
"George was brilliant. Best man on structures I ever met. And he was as careful as any of us. But he got it anyway. And we never figured out how that happened. Anyway, that mini-outbreak killed 16 people. We had two survivors, both females, both in their early 20s, and nothing remarkable about them that we could ever find."
"Maybe they were just lucky," Alexander said, not really believing it. Things like this happened for some reason or other. It was just that he hadn't found it, though it was his job to find it.
"In any case, only 18 total victims, and that was lucky. We were over there for 6 or 7 weeks. I took a shotgun into the woods and blew up about 100 monkeys trying to find a carrier. No dice. That strain is called Ebola Zaire Mayinga. I imagine right now they're comparing it to what this little kid contracted. Ebola's a slippery little bastard.
Just one? Kathy asked.
That's the word. Method of exposure unknown as usual.
Monkey bite?
Yeah, but we'll never find the monkey. We never do.
It's that deadly? Altman asked, unable to hold back from joining the conversation.
Sir, the official guess is 80% mortality. Put it this way. If you pull your pistol out and shoot me in the chest right here, right now, the odds are better than beating this little bug.
Alexander buttered his roll and remembered visiting Westfall's widow. It was bad for the appetite.
Probably a lot better, what with the surgeons we have working over in Halstead. You have much better odds with leukemia, much better odds with lymphoma. Somewhat worse odds with AIDS, but that agent gives you 10 years. Ebola gives you maybe 10 days. That's about as deadly as it gets.
Chapter 11. Monkeys. Ryan had done all of his own writing. He'd published 2 books on naval history. That now seemed like a previous lifetime summoned to memory on a hypnotist's couch, and uncounted papers for CIA. Each of these he had done himself, once on a typewriter and later on a series of personal computers. He had never enjoyed the writing. It was ever difficult work. But he had enjoyed the solitude of it, alone in his own little intellectual world, and safe from any sort of interruption as he formed his thoughts and adjusted their method of presentation, until they were as close to perfect as he could achieve. In that way, they were always his thoughts, and there was integrity in the process. No longer. The chief speechwriter was Callie Weston, short, petite, dirty blonde, and a wizard with words who, like many of the enormous White House staff, had come aboard with President Fowler and never managed to leave.
"You didn't like my speech for the church?"
She was also irreverent.
"Honestly, I just decided that I had to say something else."
Then Jack realized he was defending himself to someone he scarcely knew.
"I cried."
She paused for effect, staring into his eyes with the unblinking gaze of a poisonous snake for several seconds, manifestly sizing him up.
"You're different."
"What do you mean?"
"I mean, you have to understand, Mr. President. President Fowler kept me around because I made him sound compassionate. He's rather a cold fish in most things, poor guy. President Durling kept me around because he didn't have anybody better. I bump heads all the time with staffers across the street. They like to edit my work. I don't like being edited by drones. We fight. Arnie protects me a lot because I went to school with his favorite niece, and I'm the best around at what I do. But I'm probably the biggest pain in the ass on your staff. You need to know that."
It was a good explanation, but not to the point.
"Why am I different?" Jack asked.
"You say what you really think instead of saying what you think people think they want to hear. It's going to be hard writing for you. I can't dip into the usual well. I have to learn to write the way I used to like to write, not the way I'm paid to write. And I have to learn to write like you talk. It's going to be tough," she told him, already girding herself for the challenge.
"I see." Since Ms. Weston was not an Inner Circle staff member, Andrea Price was leaning against the wall. It would have been in a corner, except the Oval Office didn't have one, and observing everything with a poker face. Or trying to. Ryan was learning to read her body language. Clearly Price didn't much care for Weston. He wondered why.
"Well, what can you turn out in a couple of hours?"
"Sir, that depends on what you want to say," the speechwriter pointed out. Ryan told her in a few brief sentences. She didn't take notes. She merely absorbed it, smiled, and spoke again.
"They're going to destroy you. You know that. Maybe Arnie hasn't told you yet. Maybe nobody on the staff has or ever will, but it's going to happen."
That remark jolted Agent Price from her spot on the wall, just enough that her body was standing instead of leaning.
"What makes you think I want to stay here?"
She blinked. "Excuse me, I'm not really used to this."
"This could be an interesting conversation, but
I read one of your books day before yesterday. You're not very good with words. Not very elegant, that's a technical judgment, but you do say things clearly. So I have to dial back my rhetoric style to make it sound like you. Short sentences. Your grammar is good. Catholic schools, I guess. You don't bullshit people. You say it straight." She smiled. "How long for the speech?"
"Call it 15 minutes.
"I'll be back in 3 hours," Weston promised, and stood. Ryan nodded, and she walked out of the room. Then the president looked at Agent Price.
"Spit it out," he ordered.
"She's the biggest pain in the ass over there. Last year she attacked some junior staffer over something. A guard had to pull her off him."
"Over what?"
"The staffer said some nasty things about one of her speeches and speculated that her family background was irregular. He left the next day." "No loss," Price concluded. "But she's an arrogant prima donna. She shouldn't have said what she did."
"What if she's right?"
"Sir, that's not my business, but any—"
"Is she right?"
"You are different, Mr. President." Price didn't say whether she thought that was a good or bad thing, and Ryan didn't ask. The president had other things to do in any case. He lifted his desk phone, and a secretary answered.
"Could you get me George Winston at the Columbus Group?"
"Yes, Mr. President, I'll get him for you."
She didn't have that number immediately to mind, and so she lifted another phone for the signals office. Down there, a Navy petty officer had the number on a post-it note and read it off. A moment later, he handed the post-it to the Marine in the next chair over. The Marine fished in her purse, found 4 quarters, and handed them over to the smirking squid.
"Mr. President, I have Mr. Winston," the intercom phone said.
"George?"
"Yes, sir."
"How fast can you get down here?"
"Jack, Mr. President, I'm trying to put my business back together and—"
"How fast?" Ryan asked more pointedly.
Winston had to think for a second. His Gulfstream crew wasn't standing by for anything today, getting to Newark Airport.
"I can catch the next train."
"Let me know which one you're on. I'll have something waiting for you."
"Okay, but you need to know that I can't—"
"Yes, you can. See you in a few hours." Ryan hung up, then looked up to Price. "Andrea, have an agent and a car meet him at the station."
"Yes, Mr. President."
Ryan decided that it was nice to give orders and have them carried out. A man could get used to this.
"I don't like guns."
She said it loudly enough that a few heads turned, though the kids immediately turned back to their blocks and crayons. There was an unusual number of adults around, 3 of whom had spiraling cords leading to earpieces. Those heads all turned to see a concerned—that was the word everyone used in such a case—mother. As head of this detail, Don Russell walked over.
"Hello?"
He held up his Secret Service ID. "Can I help you?"
"Do you have to be here?"
"Yes, ma'am, we do. Could I have your name, please?"
"Why?"
Sheila Walker demanded.
"Well, ma'am, it's nice to know who you're talking to, isn't it?" Russell asked reasonably.
It was also nice to get background checks on such people.
"This is Mrs. Walker," said Mrs. Marlene Daggett, owner-operator of Giant Steps Daycare Center.
"Oh, that's your little boy over there, Justin, right?"
Russell smiled. The 4-year-old was building a tower with hardwood blocks, which he would then tip over to the general amusement of the room.
"I just don't like guns, and I don't like them around children."
"Mrs. Walker, first of all, we're cops. We know how to carry our firearm safely. Second, our regulations require us to be armed at all times. Third, I wish you would look at it this way. Your son is as safe here with us as he's ever going to be. You'll never have to worry about having somebody come over and steal a kid off the playground outside, for example."
Why does she have to be here?
Russell smiled reasonably. Mrs. Walker, Katie over there didn't become president. Her father did.